Thank you for the invitation, organizing all that. My talk will be quite different in the sense that it's not really anything to do with quantum gravity, actually maybe not even with quantizing time. It's classical mechanics and the language that we're using, which is mathematics, of course. And maybe just on this first slide, so the main message, the main take-home message is really this one here, namely real numbers are not really real. So it may be easy to remember that. Okay, so let me start. What is time? Of course, as Saint Augustine already said, we don't really know. I mean, maybe there are many people who know, but they have probably different opinions. One thing, of course, that one could say is time is what ideal clocks measure. We had already mentions of that. We need an ideal clock. Ideal clocks do not really exist. Maybe more like these ones. But a clock is an open, irreversible system. Could also be affected, for instance, by quantum noise. The idea that there is something like this parameter evolution that exists, that appears in a Newton's equation or appears in the Schrödinger equation, or this geometric time in relativity is certainly something that seems to have something to do with the world. And so maybe we could call that Parmenides geometric time. And it is time when what matters is being. But I have already said here, I don't think this is exhausting time, the concept of time. And another very essential aspect, in my opinion, of time is that there's a time before and a time after an event. For instance, time before and after a random bit is produced, or before and after I made some decision. So let me tell you a bit about my motivation, why I think this is so important. And I think there are really two very different types of motivations here. First one has to do with telling stories. So of course, we physicists, we produce models of reality, and these models should be faithful. And that means that we should predict correct empirical facts. That is certainly necessary, but I think very important is that actually this by itself does not produce any explanation, is certainly not satisfying, and we need something more. And this other thing, my way of expressing is that a good physical model of reality should allow humans to tell story about how nature does it. We never teach physics just by a list of empirical predictions or mathematical equations. We always start with stories. I think this is essential to have or to gain some understanding. Now, what is a story? Well, there's no way to tell stories without the passage of time. Somehow, to think of an event is to think something in time, as Yuval Dolev, a philosopher in Jerusalem, wrote, for instance. So maybe a way of summarizing this first motivation, on which I'm not going to say more, is by paraphrasing Rabelais and saying that science without time is but the ruin of intelligibility. So that's one type of motivation for myself. And a second one has to do with quantum mechanics. I spent my career doing quantum information, quantum foundations, everything with quantum, and in particular, quantum randomness. So here you have, for instance, a sketch of a quantum random number generator, a single photon source, simply a beam splitter, two single photon detectors, one you label zero, the other one you label one. And of course, the string of bits that come out is random. And so here, if we've come from these viewpoints, if you come more from the quantum side than from general relativity, let's say, you get a picture very different from the previous talk, according to which new information gets created as time passes. And indeed, this is something that we have in textbooks, but we don't have it only in textbooks. For instance, engineers have been able to put all that into a microscopic or millimeter size chip, low power consumption, which you can now find in some smartphones. So in some years, everybody will have a quantum random number generator in its pocket. There will be quantum computers, quantum cryptography, and all that. And I think the general picture will be that there is randomness. So I think that is something which is coming anyway. But of course, you may argue that this is just one interpretation of quantum physics, that there are different ones, and so on. So let me just remind ourselves that from Bell inequalities, you can really derive quantum indeterminacy and quantum randomness. So let's suppose we have two of these quantum random number generator, and here, cheating a little bit, I suppose I have an input, which in the commercial device you don't have, but you know that you could do that with some phases or polarization analyzer that one can rotate. So you have some measurement settings, you get some outcomes on both sides. And then let's make some assumptions. One, that there is no instantaneous communication at the distance. So this, I'm just talking about any finite speed. I'm not talking about the speed of light, although usually one here refers to the speed of light, but if the speed of light would be a billion times larger, but still finite, the same argument would still hold on the paper at least. And the second assumption is there's no conspiracy, so the existence of independent variables. So these measurement settings can be independent of the rest of the experiment, again, on both sides. And then there is a fact, you can violate Bell inequality, and then there is a mathematical theorem, namely that the outcomes, again, on both sides, are truly random. And you can, okay, you can read about that in my book, but you can also go to Nature if you are more impressed by Nature. But anyway, this is a mathematical theorem. You can, there's no way around it. Of course, you can pretend that one of these two assumptions is incorrect. But if you assume, if you accept the assumptions, the result follows. And you can be even quantitative about that. You know, how much randomness comes out is not necessarily one bit per outcome, but there's some randomness provided you get a violation. Okay, so the conclusion we have to face is that our world is not deterministic. I know that some people will disagree, but this is my talk. And the universe is open. Nature is able of acts of pure creation. Okay, so that's the second part of this motivation. And now let's continue. What is time? So here we had this clock, but I think a better clock for my presentation is actually the sand clock. Not because it is more accurate, it's just the opposite, of course. But in this sand clock, you can ask, let's consider two of these grains of sand here, let's say, top of this pile. Which one is going to be first in passing to the lower half? And you may say, okay, this is a chaotic system, but equations are deterministic, so it is determined. Of course, we don't know, but it is determined. But actually, and I will come back to that, you may also say this is a chaotic classical system. Maybe it is really truly indeterministic which grain of sand passes before the other. There might be some indeterminacy here, as we have in quantum. And then we really have a different sort of time here, a different picture. So time is also the accumulation of many little events. And this is maybe a time that would naturally be named Heraclitus' creative time. So time when what matters is change. Of course, you may say, but yeah, there are also creation or deterministic creation, or creation in a deterministic world. But for me, deterministic creation is not real creation, because whatever novelty arises is really just an unfolding of what came before. And now, instead of creation, you may say event. In my language, this is synonymous. So you see, okay, now I want to see, can we really make sense of what I'm saying here, that this chaotic system might be really described by Newton's equation, but really non-deterministic. And here I come to this intuitionistic mathematics, and I'll present a first encounter. It's not really, I mean, I'm going to present more about it, but let me start by putting some grain of doubts into your brain, since all of you, and myself included, we have all been trained in classical mathematics, and we have all been selected by our ability to swallow classical mathematics. So it's difficult to change this kind of understanding of mathematics. But let's start with simple things. So numbers are there to count, 1, 2, 3, 4, so on. But how can it then be that most of the so-called real numbers are not computable? Of course, you cannot count them. They cannot even be computed. But let's start not with real numbers, but with integers. And actually, you'll see even bits, zero and ones, very simple concepts. And let me define the bit n1 to be equal to zero if every even integer between 4 and, let's say, 10 to the 4 is the sum of two primes, and n1 equal 1 otherwise. So, of course, probably most of you don't know the answer, but all of you would be able to just go to your computer in a matter of a few minutes, or tens of minutes, you will find the answer. And so you would find that n1 is actually equal to zero. And so there's no doubt that even if you don't know the value of n1, n1 has a determined value. It's just a matter of, in a finite time, you can compute it. Now let's define another integer, n2, which is equal to zero if every integer between 4 and a huge number is the sum of two primes, and n2 equal 1 otherwise. So now here, no one is going to jump on a computer to try to compute it, because this is such a large number that it would take much too long to be of any relevance. So here, actually, probably no one on this planet knows the value of n2. Nevertheless, n2, I guess we will all agree, has a determined value. After all, there is a finite algorithm, simple algorithm, and in a finite time, you're going to find out the value of n2. So n2 has a determined value. And you see now where I'm heading. n3 equals zero if every even integer larger than 4 without any upper bound is the sum of two prime. This is actually the same as Goldbach conjecture in number theory. And so here again, no one knows the value of n3. But not only no one knows the value of n3, but there is no known algorithm that is going to tell us the value of n3. So does n3 have a value? Well, if you are a good student in physics or in mathematics, you know that in order not to fail the exam, you have to claim that n3 has a determined value. Of course, you don't know it, but it has one. Except actually, and that's where really intuitionist mathematics enters the picture, except if the exam is in intuitionistic mathematics, then the good student should answer that the value of n3 is indeterminate and that the law of the excluded middle is not valid. Now, you have not only two possibilities, you have three possibilities. Okay, for this bit, it's the bit 0, the bit 1, and the value indeterminate. Now you may say, but maybe in a year time or in some time, someone will find proof of Goldbach conjecture or find a counterexample. And then, according to intuitionist mathematics, the value of this number n3 may evolve over time from indeterminate to a determinate value. So this is shocking, I guess, to everyone who has been trained in mathematics or in physics. Because we have even numbers, well-defined apparently numbers that are indeterminate, and even the idea that the value of a number evolves over time. So, you know, it's a mathematical object or simple as a bit whose value may evolve in time is completely contrary to what we have been trained in. But maybe that helps to describe time. Yeah, at least there is someone who agrees with me here. I can hear that. Okay, so this standpoint, let me just read a bit. So Karl Pozzi, one of the specialists, he wrote, "We humans have finite memories, finite attention spans, and finite lives. So we can fully grasp only finitely many finite size pieces of a compound thing. There is no infinite helicopter which would allow us to survey the whole terrain and to tell how things will look at the end of time." You know, it's like when you are in this a road with many forks, you could indeed take a helicopter and look into the future, how it looks. But such a helicopter, especially infant helicopter, does not exist. Eret Bishop, another famous constructive mathematician, he wrote that classicist, classical mathematics, wishes to describe God's mathematics. The constructivist, to describe the mathematics of finite beings, man's mathematics for short. Constructive mathematics does not postulate a pre-existing universe with objects lying around waiting to be collected and grouped into sets, like shells on a beach. Here, things get created or constructed as time passes. And Brouwer, who is really the father of intuitionist mathematics, said, nature simply has not yet fully determined all objects. Now, for a physicist, that's perfectly fine, I guess. At least many physicists could agree that maybe nature is still creating the future. But Brouwer also saw that for mathematics. And he, okay, you can compare that, of course, to the uncertainty principle well-known in quantum mechanics. So the essence of that's the essence of intuitionism. Now, maybe some of you start to get worried and think, okay, if we change now from the classical mathematics, the mathematics we have learned, to this kind of mathematics that includes these objects that are not fully determined, can we still do physics? And here I want to reassure you that indeed with intuitionist mathematics, you can compute and prove theorems, not always exactly the same theorems as the classical, as the theorems in classical mathematics, and maybe sometimes the proofs are a bit different, but for sure, everything one can do on a classical computer, which is of course a finite object, can be done with intuitionist mathematics. And for instance, one very important aspect of today's physics is climate physics. And what do climate physicists do? They should put the initial condition of the climate, of the atmosphere, all that, the oceans, into their computers. But the computer is finite and the system is chaotic. So the more they want to simulate the evolution into the future, the more digits they need, the more data they need. And this data we don't even have. We cannot measure all that with such precision. So actually the way they do it is to use truncated numbers. We put in what we could measure with significant digits. And then they add, as time passes, time in the simulation, they add what is necessary as just stochastic reminders. So actually all these physicists are doing, without knowing, intuitionist mathematics. So clearly we all know that the language we use when we speak has an enormous influence on the worldview that physics presents to us. And in intuitionism, time is essential. So statements can become provable. I'm just repeating, but now I'm citing the Stanford Encyclopedia of Physics, of Philosophy, to be on the safe side. Okay. Now Brouwer, so the father of intuitionism, he was a very strange character. He was essentially a kind of solipsist, and he didn't go along very well with many of his fellows. And for instance, also the way he was presenting his mathematics was using the concept of an ideal mathematician, one of these guys who proved possibly this Goldbach conjecture. Sometimes he was calling it the creating subject. And this subject was continuously producing new information by solving mathematical conjectures. So this way of presenting intuitionist mathematics doesn't look to me very appealing to do physics. So I will present intuitionism without any of this ideal mathematician, and I will motivate it by the concept, the physical concept of indeterminism, randomness. So most likely Brouwer would not have liked my presentation, because indeed I'm just a physicist, so I'm a realist, a naive realist. And so my main claim is that intuitionist mathematics is the natural mathematical tool to describe the passage of time and indeterminism in physics. Similarly to derivative, which is the natural tool to describe velocities. So let's take an example of a chaotic system. Sorry?
10 minutes plus questions.
Already? Oh, okay, so I'll go fast. So an example where it's essentially the Baker map. The Baker map, if you write it in binary form, so the state space is a number between 0 and 1, so in bits it's 0 dots series of bits, and the time step is just to drop the first bit and to shift the second one to the first position, the third one to the second, and so on. And now, obviously, whether X lies on the left or right half after n steps depends on the nth bit of the initial condition. So now you may ask, is this millionth or billionth, whatever bit of the initial condition physically real? Of course, you may ask, what does it mean physically real? And certainly the question is not whether we can measure it. Of course, we cannot measure it. But does it correspond to something physical? You know, if you say yes, it corresponds to something physical, then this map is not only the map, but the map plus the initial condition is deterministic. If you say it is not physically real, it doesn't correspond to some physical, then as time passes, you will have to add random bits. Okay, so since I have very little time, real numbers, I would suspect here everybody knows that a real number contains infinite information, and that actually the only real good way of thinking of a typical real number is really the outcome of a true random number generator. This is a typical real number, and all typical real numbers are of that sort. Okay, let's go on. So when we say let x0 be the initial condition, a real number, we are actually effectively saying let x0 denote an infinite amount of information. So usually we assume that we really have this infinite amount of information given as initial condition. So mathematical real numbers are not physically real if you don't believe in physical infinity. Mathematical real numbers are maybe better termed physically random. And these random numbers cannot be the basis of scientific determinism. Let me just go over that since we don't have time. So whether classical mechanics is deterministic or not is actually not a scientific question. It really depends on the physical significance one associates with mathematical real number. Again, if you say these are physically real, then you have determinism. If you say these are not physically real, then you don't have determinism. And so somehow intuitionism brings classical closer to quantum. You know, most people, including myself for a long time, try to bring quantum closer to classical because we have the feeling we understand classical better, but maybe actually we don't understand classical physics, even Newtonian physics, that well. Okay, there were lots of big meetings, and the one that is relevant to us this today is the one between David Hilbert, known to everyone here, Hilbert space and all that. So I take him as a representative of classical mathematics, where every real number is an individual completed entity. All digits are all given at once. And so the continuum, let's say all the numbers between 0 and 1, or all the real numbers, is just a collection of individual points. And they all exist somehow outside of time in some Platonistic world. Brouwer, on the other side, the father of intuitionistic mathematics, for him, real numbers are processes that develop in time. So digits are not all given at once, okay, except for computable numbers. And the continuum is a viscous collection of processes. So I want just now to try to tell you how to understand that. So Brouwer, in his approach, he was using the terminology of choice sequences. So n is an integer, 1, 2, 3, 4, and so on. And alpha of n is the nth element of this choice sequence. And for him, it was made by an idealized mathematician. For me, it is just nature that has the power to produce true randomness, so to produce new information. And if you want to describe the passage of time with creation of new information, I think something like that is unavoidable. So you have this natural random process that outputs, let's say for simplicity, just random bits R of n at each time instant n. And then at each, okay, that's what I just said, there is this random bit coming out. And then you have a computable function that computes the next element of these choice sequences from the previous one and from all the existing information. Of course, not the information that comes, that will come in the future, but from all the existing information at that time step or at that instance. And we are going to assume that the sequence alpha n is converging. So a very simple example is just to take the last bit produced by the natural random number generator and to put it, to put it as the nth bit of your real number between 0 and 1. So this is something we could call a totally random number. Of course, you have computable numbers. On computable numbers, the function is not going to depend on the entire information, but just on a seed, a finite seed here. And in this way, you can make all these pseudo-random numbers, or you can do pi. I'm going to jump also over pi. Then you can have another example of intuitionist numbers, which we call with my co-author Flavio Del Santo, finite information quantities. And here the idea is that you take a finite, the last k random bits, and you do a majority vote. And by doing this majority, you introduce some correlations in your sequence of bits. So it's not a totally random one, you have correlations in your series of bits. Okay. Now you have this very interesting type of intuitionist number, mortal number, as I call them. I mean, Brouwer already introduced it, but not with this terminology. So the idea is that it's going to oscillate around 1/2, you know, plus or minus, depending whether this Rn is a 0 or a 1, and it converges. So it oscillates around 1/2, but it goes on only until, by chance, the last half random bits were all of the same value, maybe all 1 or all zeros. And once that happened, that event happened, then it stops. The series or this choice sequence terminates or dies, and it stays, it sticks there. Maybe it sticks slightly below 1/2 or maybe slightly above 1/2. However, because the probability of termination decreases exponentially, there is an a priori probability that a sequence goes on forever. So here you see you have these numbers that could oscillate forever, or finish on one side of 1/2 or on the other side of 1/2. And so you see that as long as the number is not, didn't die, a proposition like alpha, so the limiting value, is smaller than 1/2, is neither true nor false, but indeterminate. Okay, these are different. Okay, then you have also some logic that you can do here. And for instance, as I just said, yeah, this alpha smaller than 1/2 is indeterminate. And these I like to really put in parallel with the more physical claim. It will rain in exactly 1 year from now at Piccadilly Circus. And I believe this is indeterminate as today. It's just not yet determinate. And it has a very similar flavor of indeterminacy for this mathematical statement in intuitionistic mathematics here. And in both cases, to know the answer, you have to wait. Here you know it, you have to wait exactly 1 year. Here you don't know exactly how long you have to wait. So the law of this excluded middle is not valid, which is certainly very surprising. You have no longer non-constructive proofs, but it makes plenty of sense in an indeterministic world, a world in which the future is open. Okay, now since you have some sequences that you never know, well, you don't know yet whether they're going to be smaller or larger than 1/2. 1/2 is not an element you can just pick out of the continuum. It's not something which is like a shell on the beach finished. You cannot take it out, at least not at a finite time. And so there is this Brouwer theorem that says that all functions, total functions, so functions which are defined everywhere, we have to be continuous. Of course, this is again very surprising to us, but it doesn't really matter. We know that every step function can be very well, arbitrarily well approximated by a continuous function that would go just very fast from one value to another one. Okay, you have our theorems that change. You can also do mathematics or arithmetics. you can define all these relations. I don't want to go into these details here, but let me go again emphasizing the importance of language. And here in this table, I like to again put in parallel indeterministic physics on one side with intuitionist mathematics. So for instance, in indeterminist physics, past, present, and future, especially future, are not all given at once. That's what we mean when we say that maybe we have a indeterministic model of our world. And in intuitionist mathematics, digits of real numbers are not all given at once. Time passes. Numbers are processes. So the fact that these numbers are evolving in time is the natural analog of the passage of time. Indeterminism, finite information. The present is fixed. That's, I think, an intuition that I share with several people. And here it comes with this idea that the continuum is viscous, the idea that you cannot pick a number, just take it out. It's like trying to take a honey molecule out of a pot. It's going to be viscous. You cannot just take one out. The future is open, no law of the excluded middle, becoming choice sequences, experiencing intuitionism. Okay, how much time do I have left? I still have a bit of time, isn't it? So let me tell you a bit now, how does that fit in special relativity? Let's try with special relativity first. Well, we take now very seriously the idea that we have really a bit here, which used to be indeterminate, so that the proposition A equals zero has just no true value. And of course, when in the future, once this bit has been produced, then A has a determined value and the proposition A equals zero is either true or false. Okay, is that compatible with relativity? And I think I'm going to say yes. Maybe here to emphasize, I'm not talking here about epistemology, but really I'm trying to talk about ontology. And clearly, if a bit is indeterminate, ontologically, it cannot be known. It can be known only if it is, it can be known only if it is determined. Okay, so let's suppose now we think also of, so what is the answer here? So what is the value here outside the future light cone of this event? And so now the claim here is like for epistemology, for ontology, all here, the value of this bit is equally indeterminate as it was in the past. It's only inside this future light cone that it gets determinate. Now, if we have two of them, let's say at some distance, same story, of course, for Bob here, on the second observer here. And for instance, now a relation between the two bits will be determinate, like A plus B modulo 2, only in the intersection of the future light cones. Okay. Now, if we apply that to some quantum scenario with some entangled state, okay, singlet or whatever, and we perform some measurements at two space-like separated location, and here, let's say, we measure in a basis x, if it's a spin, and we get, let's suppose, the result plus one. So plus one will be in this future light cone. And similarly, plus x here. And so because we started with a singlet, the other one would be described here correctly with minus x, the opposite. And here we choose, Bob choose a measurement basis y. Let's suppose again that he gets the result plus one. Similar story. So now he would get a y here. So he would describe the other particle with minus y because he knows it started with a singlet. And the collapse, the usual collapse that we usually assign would happen only in the intersection of the future light cone. So it's only in this intersection that the usual collapse happens. And for instance, here, we still have a singlet state. So everywhere is the correct description of these two particles. Of course, the two particles are only following these two paths here in this space-time diagram. But the correct description is a psi minus here outside both light cones. And collapse happened only in this intersection. And so I think the conclusion is maybe provocative again, that there is no wave function of the universe. It really depends where you look at, and you can find more in this archive paper. Okay, so let me come to the conclusion. I see that we already have plenty of hands raised. So the language is very important, and very importantly, some conclusions one is tempted to infer from physics, like determinism and the illusion of time, are actually inspired by the language, the mathematical language, and not by the facts. And if you go back to classical real numbers and classical mechanics, actually one could really say that classical real numbers are the hidden variables of classical mechanics. They are hidden in the sense that obviously there is no way to get access to these real numbers, at least not to the entire real number. And it is this classical real number, these hidden variables that actually determine the future of classical mechanics or classical dynamical systems according to the theory. Whether nature is like that or not is an open question. So classical mathematics assumes a view from the end of time. So of course, if you went until the end of time, then everything is determined. Okay, I think I'll stop here. Thank you very much for your understanding, and I'm ready to answer questions.
Thank you so much, Nicholas, for such a great and clear talk. Let's we have some time for the questions. Let's start with Patrick.
Hello, yes, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you. I'm putting you so that I can even see you. Hi.
Excellent, hello. So thanks a lot for a wonderful talk. I'm very interested in this work, and I've also been very interested in the papers that it's based on. And I kind of want to make sense of what your view is about how we use scientific theories to represent the world. Because I think there's something interesting going on here. So this switch to intuitionistic mathematics or constructive mathematics or things like that, at the bottom, that's kind of a move to epistemic conservatism. Like, we want to kind of take this step to be more, more careful about what we commit to, about the sorts of things we can have knowledge of. And I think that that's a very natural step to take. If you go to intuitionistic epistemology, you get these very nice perspectives in which you can very clearly index the kind of epistemic tasks that we as scientists carry out, deductions that we carry out with informal frameworks, experimental observations. You can very cleanly index those using the sort of like Kripke frames and stuff that you see in intuitionistic logic. And that's a very nice step to take. And I think that's very interesting. But I'm a bit worried that that doesn't necessarily match up with, if you want to adopt a realist view of your theories, that it's going to do an adequate job of having a correspondingly natural interpretation for things like physical quantities. So on the one hand, adopting intuitionism and intuitionistic maxims is very conservative from the perspective of epistemology. But once you get into this framework where things like the numerical resolution of quantities instantiated by physical entities starts to become a time-determined process, that seems to require very, perhaps, at least from my perspective, fairly unnatural ontological commitments. Like, I would, for instance, what's the mechanism
of
about?
Yeah. I think I understand your question and the worry. So I believe I'm a realist, a very strong realist. And I think being a realist also implies that you don't commit to ontology that is not that doesn't have a counterpart in epistemology. So for instance, saying that a number has a value when it is actually completely inaccessible, is a very strong assumption. And as a realist, I may say also, no, I don't want to assume that something exists or really exists, whatever that exactly means, if I have actually, not only in practice, but even in principle, no way to access it.
Right. So you really do want to say, like, if something is true about the world, then it's possible for me to have knowledge of it. Provided my theory
at least in principle, mm-hmm. Not in practice. In practice, I know very well that this, many things are impossible to do in practice. It's difficult, right. But at least in principle.
Okay,
in principle, I could do it. It's like my number N2, you know, the number N2 whose upper bound was, I don't remember, 10 to the 1,000, whatever. Mm-hmm. Of course, I will never be able to compute it on my finite computer. But in principle, it's just a matter of being patient and waiting a finite time.
Right. Okay. So you're kind of only going to attribute reality to those things you can actually kind of get some sort of demonstration of and convince yourself of and just sort of forget about anything else that could in principle be possible. Okay, cool. Yeah, that makes sense. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
We're already over time, but maybe we can do a quick question and then move all the rest of the questions to the discussion session, if you don't mind. Maybe Francisco, you can ask your question if you think it's quick.
Well, I don't know if it's quick.
Let's try, and if not, we can continue.
I was just wondering how, if this work is continuous with your previous work in collapse theories, if you are trying to move, classical mechanics more towards quantum theory, because in collapse theories you have like this manifest indeterminism or stochasticity.
Yeah. One of the things. So let me interrupt you and just say, so this is an example of stochastic Schrödinger equations, and of course I didn't write here the equation, but you have stochastic equations and so on. And if you look at all these equations, whether it is used by GRW or quantum state diffusion or whatever, they always use some version of this gambler ring game, which is exactly these sort of intuitionistic numbers. So you can make a connection here, but I would also admit that the connection so far that I have been able to establish is still a bit vague and shaky. So on the quantum side, I would still present myself as a collapse guy, but, you know, I would even prefer to say, I just don't know, because I just don't know is the most honest answer. But if you press me and give me enough beer, I will go for collapse models. And indeed, there is a way of making a connection, but I'm not sure this is a very deep connection.
Thank you.
All right. I'll invite everyone to thank the speaker again. And if you don't mind, we just move the rest of the questions to the discussion session. Thank you so much, Nicholas.
Thank you.